Mormon Stories Podcast is made possible through the financial contributions of its listeners. To keep it alive and available to future generations, please consider a donation today at mormonstories.org. This interview was also recorded in high-definition video and can be viewed at mormonstories.org, on YouTube at youtube.com/mormonstories, and in iTunes as part of the podcast feed. Thank you for joining us today on Mormon Stories. I'm John DeLynn. Today, I have with me a very special guest. I feel like I say that every time. This time, I mean it extra specially well. I have with us today author, playwright, artist, Carolyn Pearson. Carolyn, welcome to Mormon Stories Podcast.
John, I thank you for inviting me. I'm grateful to be here.
Well, I have to warn you up front, give you a little disclaimer, that I may not be at my complete best today during an interview, but I want to tell you why. There's three reasons, and this is not a setup. This is factual. The first reason is this book, Goodbye, I Love You, which I believe you published first in 1986, which we'll be discussing as the main frame for today's interview. It says here, the true story of a wife, her homosexual husband, and a love that transcended tragedy. Should say a Mormon wife, but I realize why they didn't do that. The second reason that I haven't been getting enough sleep lately is this second book, No More Goodbyes, Circling the Wagons Around Our Gay Loved Ones, also by you. And the third reason is one that sort of confirms at times my belief in some supreme power being when I'm feeling a little less confident. And that's that this morning at 6 a.m. after getting to bed well past 1 in the morning, I received a call from an old friend. And the old friend had no idea what I was doing this morning. He had no idea that I interviewed Bruce Bastian a week or two ago. But he knew that I was maybe a safe place for him to share some feelings and thoughts. And he called me this morning at 6 a.m. and woke me up and started telling me the story of how he's always known he was gay. We knew each other growing up, how he talked to his bishops. They encouraged him to go on a mission, that the mission would fix it. He prayed and fasted. He went on to return home from his mission. Didn't fix it, but he was told that maybe if he got married, when he got married, first time he had that experience with a woman, that would fix it. And now he's several children into mm-hmm. his marriage. Mm-hmm. And he's trying to decide what to do with his life.
Yeah.
And that's the theme for today. And that's the theme of your first book, Goodbye, I Love You.
Yes.
So,
yes.
Those are my reasons for being a little bit droopy-eyed. You'll have to forgive me, but I will be up to this interview, I promise.
Of course.
But in typical Mormon Stories fashion, before we dive into the main substance of your life's work, I would love to have you talk about anything you want to talk about related to your heritage, your ancestry, and your upbringing, and especially touching on the things that might be relevant to the things we're going to discuss later today.
Sure. Thank you. My Mormon heritage is a very deep and strong one. I have George Warren Serine, who came across on the ship Brooklyn, went on to help found Mesa, Arizona. I have
chipped
Thomas Morris.
Ice. You can't forget the chipping ice.
He
part.
Was one of the guys who was let overboard to chip the ice. True. Absolutely.
To keep the boat afloat or whatever?
Well, when they encountered this terrible storm out in the ocean. I have Thomas Morris, who marched with the Mormon battalion. We have his diary, how he boiled his second shirt for something to eat, leather, I am sure. I have my own grandmother, not my great-grandmother, but my own grandmother, my mother's mother, Sarah Oki, who walked across the plains as an eight-year-old girl. All of those stories have been hugely important to me. as I grew up and are now. I take my Mormon heritage very, very seriously. So I was born in Salt Lake City. My mother and father were a bit older when they married and had us. They had five children. We spent 5 years out in Gusher, Utah. You've never heard of that, have you?
Never.
Two of those years out on a place we euphemistically called a ranch, had no running water or electricity. We had to go to the outhouse in the middle of the night. And then we moved to Provo. My mother saved her salary as a school teacher so that she could get us out of Gusher. And we moved to Provo, which was a very good place for me. I had a wonderful experience going to the late, great BY High School and then BYU in the drama department, majoring in drama and minoring in English, and being in a lot of plays and having really a fine experience at BYU. And we could go on any number of directions here, but help me figure out where we want to go
was
now.
I'm gonna not put you on the spot and try and explore which decade that was, but was the drama department considered at all edgy or progressive?
No.
It was very...
No. Oh, it was very standard. Well, you see, there's always something a little bit edgy about theater. There just is. You can't have theater without pushing some of the borders a little bit. But we didn't push them a lot, and we occasionally had to rewrite a line in order for it to be acceptable. When I played Lady Bracknell in The Importance of Being Earnest, rather than saying to, what's his name, "Do you smoke?" That line was rewritten, so I said, "Do you golf?" Absurd kinds of things like that. So no, the drama department was very, very safe. And I had some really good professors there. And I have best memories of being at BYU.
Was this pre-Ernest Wilkinson or during Ernest Wilkinson?
During.
Okay. All right. Those are good years.
Yeah.
All right. So you're acting. I imagine you're getting good grades.
Very good grades.
Yeah.
I was always a good student.
Couple awards here and there.
Yep.
Some writing awards, is that right?
I got I won first place in a poetry contest there. And 2 years running, I got the best actress award in the drama department.
At BYU.
Uh-huh. For Sarah in the play JB, a modern poetic retelling of the story of Job. And then my favorite, as I played Joan of Arc in Ennui's version, called The Lark. Oh, yeah.
So were you, I mean, this is an embarrassing question, but were you kind of a bit of an item, bit of a catch at the university? I can imagine.
You're speaking like, did the boys all come in my direction? Oh, no.
No?
No, oh, no, 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 no. No, I had a lot of good friends, male and female, and I did some dating. But no, I was not one of the girls who was always out there dating and being pursued. But I did have some good experiences with guys.
How would you characterize your relationship with the church, your experiences in the church as a youth and as a young adult, just in terms of how constructive or healthy it was for your psyche?
My psyche, I really feel that I absorbed an awful lot of the good stuff of the Mormon culture. I had a lot of good people there, MIA leaders and BYU professors, and I absorbed an awful lot of good stuff. The very first memory that I have of there being a little bit of pain that crept into my psyche was in high school when, and I had sort of known about polygamy But when my very dear seminary teacher bore us his testimony that we have many, many mothers in heaven, that polygamy is indeed an eternal principle that we will all come to understand and embrace when we are sufficiently righteous. And I remember walking home from BY High School to my home on 6th North and 6th East with something very heavy in my heart that I'd never felt. And I said, something's wrong here. I don't know what it is, but if this is my relationship, if this is what God has in mind for me, if this is God's plan for everybody, I don't get it. I just don't get it. There's something skewed here. And, well, I must actually back up a bit and say, truly, truly, I was born into women's issues. I remember from before we moved to Salt Lake, I have this odd memory, and I don't know where it came from, but I know it's a memory from when we were out in Gusher. I could have been maybe 10 or 12 or something. I remember saying to somebody, and I don't know who, but I said, well, I guess the only good thing about being a woman is you don't have to marry one. And I have thought back, where did I get that idea? My parents never gave us any idea to suggest that boys are better than girls. I truly, as I went along, I felt myself to be a real favorite of my father. My mother died when I was 15. But nobody ever said anything like that to me. But you see, it is in the air that we breathe. So somehow I came to this world looking around and saying, why is it that everything important seems to be male? Why is it that everything in church, everything in the Bible, why is it that God is male? Most people don't even begin to ask. That's just the way it is. For whatever reason, I did not just say, this is just the way it is. I said, this is the way it is. Why? And it really hurt me. It hurt me because if that is the case, that everything important is male, where does that leave me? And truly, that stayed with me for a very, very long time until somehow I figured out, you know, it's not me that's wrong. It's our perceptions, our system of explaining the world and the heavens that is wrong or incomplete or however you want to say it. But I recall truly when I was at BYU having this good experience that I told you about, I would go to the Special Collections Library, I think fourth floor, and I would go through all of the shelves of books written by the brethren, searching for any little crumb. I mastered the art of opening the book to the back and looking for W for women, M for mother in heaven. And any little crumb that I found, and believe me, they were few and far between, I would just devour it so hungrily. And then take another look and say, isn't this pathetic? This is so pathetic that I, as a woman, in a system that is laid out for me as God's best plan, have to be so hungry and be fed so little about who I am as a woman. That pain was enormous.
So you were feeling pain in high school and college,
yeah,
over the status of women.
Absolutely. And not really over my own personal status, because I was always successful and well-regarded personally in the things that I did by teachers, by relatives, by everybody. But it was this larger thing, theological, cosmological, of the place of women in the universe that to me was so extraordinarily unacceptable.
And before we, I want to dive into that pretty deeply in a little while. Let me just ask you Do you feel like you perceived yourself as having a traditional LDS testimony in spite of these doubts or concerns? Can you remember the burning in the bosom or spiritual confirmation or a certainty, or did you also not benefit from that type of experience?
I have never had some what we might call numinous experience of being taken over by the spirit saying whatever to me. But I was very comfortable in accepting everything that I was taught, and it all made good sense to me, except for these huge bumps of which we will speak and are speaking. So, I mean, it was just my life. I lived in Happy Valley, and there were no real alternative ways to think about anything except to just fall off the end of the earth. This is what it was. And much of it was very nourishing to me.
So you were swimming in the water of Mormonism and
oh, yeah.
Having a good time, but with a couple of big questions.
Yes. Yeah. Yes, indeed.
But you reflect on your youth and early church experiences overall favorably.
Yeah.
Maybe even feel blessed to have had them.
I think so. Well, you see, if we're going to get really, really broadly cosmological about why we come to this earth and all of that, I believe that the Mormon Church has served me enormously in providing for me all the good nourishing things and providing for me all the conflict that I need for the kind of personal growth that I believe we're here for.
So nourishment and conflict.
Yeah.
Both.
Yeah.
Good and bad.
Absolutely.
Okay. Okay. So before we dive in, do you have any recollection on what you would have perceived your life being like back when you were graduating from college and thinking about the path ahead, the road ahead? What do you think you envisioned for yourself back then? What your life would be like?
Oh, I was going to be certainly a pretty traditional Mormon person with a traditional Mormon family, but certainly be having opportunity to exercise my writing and perhaps my acting. But I was looking forward to a very traditional Mormon life with a traditional Mormon man and being comfortable within the borders of the church. After I graduated from the Y and I traveled for a year, we may or may not want to get into some of that, but as I went into Russia, I smuggled the Book of Mormon in and I gave it to the pastor of the whichever Christian church there, and he showed me where. Oh, here's where your Mr. Benson has signed our. So you see, I was very much in the Mormon framework of sharing the good stuff, and certainly being the kind of. Oh, I was the kind of good little Mormon girl that everybody would want. I didn't ever get into any kind of trouble. I never had a difficult adolescence in terms of being tempted to any of the things to go outside, in behavior-wise, to go outside the borders. None of that, ever.
And you saw yourself becoming a housewife. Your husband would be the primary income provider. You would do some writing maybe on the side.
Probably. I would have been open to seeing maybe a little bit more unusual configuration of the word partnership was perhaps not necessarily in my mind, but I certainly did not want to be in a marriage where I did not feel ready to be a partner to everything. And I actually remember now when I would go out with a guy, I would maybe on the first or second date, ask him how he felt about polygamy. Not that I had that many men coming to court me, but Of course, I'm sure that I felt, even in those early days, that I was not going to get myself into a traditional situation, in as much as it might lessen my opportunities.
Okay. So, what did art mean to you at that time? Like, you're growing up, you maybe fall in love with acting or theater, or do a little writing, some poetry, but like, how would you describe the force or the meaning or the purpose for you behind your self-creative expression? Is that something that you were conscious of? Were you like, I have to write, that's who I am, acting is me, you know? How important was your artistic expression to you?
Possibly not consciously as important as I know that it really, really was throughout those years. You know, I remember the first time I was on the stage in a little primary operetta. I played Raggedy Andy. I was probably about 7 years old. I remember that clearly, what the costume looked like, felt like. And then later on, when I was in plays at BYU High and then BYU, I knew there was something profoundly wonderful about the theater. And in my writing, in fourth grade, I won $4 in a school district essay contest on why we should eat a better breakfast. And I always was good with words, 100% spelling, and in high school, I began to write poetry. I have now at home a file that says poetry very bad, and a file that says poetry not quite so bad. Honestly, I do. But in high school, a really important thing was that I began to keep a diary. And I don't know why I did, because it wasn't like a church admonition that came a bit later, but I just really wanted to. So I started keeping a diary, and I have all my life, and I have this a massive amount of really rich material because I tell everything. So writing.
And may that go to the right library someday.
May it.
And not the wrong library someday.
We'll talk about that. Okay. I haven't decided yet. So writing these, so embarrassingly adolescent poems, and the diary that I have to read it at arm's length now because it's just so embarrassing. But, you know, that's who I was. That's who we all were, foolish, egocentric adolescents. But writing even this awful bad poetry that I was writing, it was helpful to me. And as I continued writing in poetry, in the later things that happened and my diary, I knew, and I remember someplace in my diary I wrote that I feel like the more of my life or thoughts that I can articulate on paper, the more I have control over. And I think keeping a diary has been one of the things that has saved me over a number of griefs that were totally devastating.
So therapeutic.
Absolutely.
Did you have any favorite writers, poets, or playwrights at that stage? And were there any you were modeling after or trying to be like?
In high school, I was crazy about Dorothy Parker, a humorist who wrote very witty, edgy, kind of wry-biting, witty poems. And I memorized a lot of her stuff. Dorothy Parker.
Okay.
And it, in high school and in college, I would go out and give programs, you know, to ladies' clubs and all of this. And so I would give some Dorothy Parker. But then in college, I truly fell in love with Emily Dickinson and Robert Frost. And
poets, right?
Yeah. So, and the many of the plays that I was in provided me with wonderful minds I remember being in playing in The Heiress, playing Catherine Sloper. I could list a dozen or more wonderful roles that I played besides Joan of Arc that made my mind grapple with words and understand and appreciate good sentences and characterization. That was all a very wonderful thing to me to put me in a place where, as you're asking, that art meant something to me. I knew that on the printed page and on the stage, magic happened. You know, and early on somewhere in my classes at BYU under dear Harold Hansen, whom I loved a lot, to become aware that in Mormon culture, theater and art in general has been very, very promoted and valued, and that Brigham insisted that the saints bring across the plains the books, the musical instrument. Pitt's Brass Band came across the plains. They started building the Bowery maybe a couple of years after they were there, where concerts and their major meetings were held. And then Brigham started very quickly to build the Salt Lake Theater and said, if I were placed on a cannibal island and given the task of educating that people, I would straightaway build a theater for the purpose. Mormonism has always had a lot of roots in theater. In Nauvoo, Brigham Young played the high priest Pizarro. There was a theater in Nauvoo. So my experience with the theater did not feel to me like any rebellious kind of thing. And it was, well, it was after I was married, but let's bring that little piece into here now. There were a lot of Mormon artists who were very much on fire about creating Mormon art. And this is really the first thing that brought Gerald and me together. He was passionate about wanting to create Mormon art, wanting to preach the gospel through the arts, through the stage, in the movies. He had these huge ideas of what he was going to do. So we were part of a group that we called Art and Belief, where my dear beloved Trevor Southey, whom I adore, and others, Dennis Clark and Marvin Payne and various others came together to just inspire each other of how we were going to change the world through Mormon art.
So give us a little background on Gerald before you talk about when you first met.
Gerald was kind of an oddball in his family in that he had cultural appetites that his family didn't really understand. And he loved music and studied music. And he was very devoted to the church. He went on a mission to Australia and had a tremendous vision of how he wanted to impact the world with his own writing and producing and all of this. He majored in drama at BYU. He was two and a half years younger than I was. He was in some plays, and he loved the theater, loved the whole idea of art. And he and I met in a play. I had come back from my year abroad, and I tried out for another play at BYU during the time that I was working as a writer at the motion picture studio under, my dear friend Scott Whitaker, and Judge Whitaker was in charge of the studio. And I tried out for The Skin of Our Teeth, that was being directed by Charles Metten.
He was a professor of mine at BYU.
Well, then, there you go.
Theater and film art analysis.
Uh-huh. So Dr. Metten cast me as Mrs. Antrobus. Of course, I wanted to be Sabina, the sexy one, but I never got to play the sexy one. I was always the...
Matronly.
Yeah. Or the strong one, you know, the more focused one. And Gerald was cast as the stage manager. Thornton Wilder often had the stage manager as a character in the play, as in Our Town. So here was this very charming, shining, blonde young man who, well, I'm sure you'll remember some of my words from Goodbye, I Love You, was like a fire to me, that I just wanted to be warmed by his fire. And he was much more charismatic and outgoing than I was. I was much more accomplished at that time than he was, but I was insecure, somewhat, in social kinds of ways, and kind of withdrawn in some ways. So I truly was just taken by him and his brightness and the way he spoke. And so that was the beginning.
And you fell in love.
Yeah, I did. And he sort of, well, yes, I really fell for Gerald. And at the end of the play, it ended on a polka, and then the curtains closed. And as the curtain closed, Gerald and I would always just finish the polka together. It was just a fun thing that we did. And then he began to come over to visit me because he loved the way I thought. And now, this should just make you laugh or whatever. I remember at one time, he brought his notebook because he didn't want to miss any of the interesting things that I had to say in our conversations.
So, wow, that's flattering.
Oh, yeah. Well, of course, but that's not what I wanted. I wanted him to just fall in love with me and just all of the romantic, wonderful devotion. Sure. So we continued our ongoing relationship of me being crazy about him and him being crazy about sort of what I was and what I represented to him and wanting to love me and truly falling in love with me as best as he could. And we...
Did you have the romantic feelings for him?
Oh, yeah.
Sexually attracted to him? And were you ever, like, saying, you know, let's make some steam? Were you ever feeling...
No. And see, this is... I, as a woman, am very... I have a lot of conflicting parts to me. Part of my womanness is very assertive about what needs to happen. And another part of me as a woman is very unable to sort of... I couldn't go out and chase a man. I couldn't do it. I couldn't do it now. If anybody assigned me to, I wouldn't know how to do it.
So you were a lady in waiting.
Yeah. So anyway, Gerald finally did start talking more seriously, and that he really would love to be able for him and me to be able to work things out. And anyway, we didn't have a long, long courtship, but we got engaged at Christmas. And I went to Murray to meet his family, and his family loved me, and his family were good, very simple people. And so there we were engaged, and I was really thrilled. I felt really good about it.
Let me ask you a question.
Uh-huh.
I asked Bruce Bashan this a couple weeks ago. He grew up, I think, in Idaho Falls. I asked him whether growing up in the 60s, I think it was the 60s, 50s or 60s, whether he even knew the word homosexual, like whether he even had sort of a framework for even contemplating that thing. Mm-hmm. Did you have that? And did you ever wonder about Gerald?
Oh,
in those early courtship years?
No, not at all. But I did have just a bit of a concept. I remember in high school, I saw some boys teasing another boy, saying, and they didn't use the word gay or whatever, the worst words that are used now, but said, so-and-so, oh, he likes boys, doesn't he? And I really don't remember any of the steps toward my mentally being able to have a construct of what that meant. But I did sort of know. But just that it was, you know, something bad, that some, like if you drink alcohol, it's a bad thing. If men were to be physical with each other, that's a bad thing. All in the same kind of category. So when, not too long after our engagement, Gerald told me we had something really, that we needed to talk about, and he had been fasting. And so he came over to where I was living, and he told me that he had, in the past, had feelings and some experiences of a homosexual nature. And, you know, I knew what he was talking about. But now, this will be weird. I was sort of relieved that he had not had sex with a woman. That, to me, at that moment, that would have been worse. Because to me, that would have been a real sexual event. This other thing was just, it was bad, but it wasn't anything to really have a lot of concern about.
To betray you.
And yeah. And Gerald was very determined and very honest, as he said to me, that's not who I really am. That's not who I want to be. I want to be with you. I want to have a family. I want to be in the church. I knew that was all very correct of his feelings. And so it wasn't a difficult thing for me to move forward with our engagement. Because as far as I knew, this thing was just a mistake that people made sometimes. And in this case, you just find a good woman who loves you, and that was certainly me, and we would be fine. So we did continue. Though not too long after that, Gerald disappeared. He broke the engagement. He just disappeared. He was terrified. And looking back, you know, I can understand why he did that. But I was devastated. I was truly heartbroken. Ooh, and you know what I just remembered from that awful first week? I, with my friend Margie, went up to hear Rodney Turner speak at a BYU evening. I think it was an evening program at the field house. And I went praying that and he was to be talking about women. And I went up humble and praying that I would receive something that would help me, because I thought, whatever's going on here, it's my fault. I'm not a woman enough for Gerald. And so I sat there in the field house and heard Rodney Turner say these things that now I know to be so excruciatingly wrong and damaging.
Who's Rodney Turner? Should I know who that is? I'm sorry.
I'm so glad you don't know. He was a BYU professor of religion, a very conservative guy, but sort of had this cult following, or he was a somebody in the religion.
Kind of like
department.
An early Bruce R. McConkie?
He wrote a book called Woman. Maybe it was just entitled Woman.
Like a caveman? Woman. Wait, Woman.
Oh no, he became known by those of us who did not see him as a friend. The person who represented the worst of patriarchy.
What did he say in this talk? Just give us the flavor.
He opened by saying, "Now I know that, oh, something like, I know that what I'm going to say might not sound quite right to you women, but this is what the way it is," or I mean, something like that. And then in his talk, he quoted this little thing for which he later became famous. I don't know if I can remember. He didn't, I'm sure he didn't write this, but this awful, awful little verse that said, "Women are doormats. The years those mats applaud, they keep their men from with muddy feet from going into God." Something like that. I mean, just unbelievable. Totally unbelievable. No, his book was entitled Woman and the Priesthood. And there's sort of the beginnings of the woman's movement happening there. And Brother Turner, like other people, had been called to set things right.
Sounds familiar.
Yeah. Oh, and then late, my next other memory of him. Wow. A few years later, there was a panel put together that was held on the University of Utah campus. I remember that Paul Toscano was on the panel. Oh, I was, and two other people were, and I'm sorry, I can't remember exactly who. But I gave my presentation, a very intelligent present. Oh, excuse me. The title of this panel was How Shall We Worship God the Mother?
Oh.
Probably sponsored by the Mormon Women's Forum. At that time, was a pretty vibrant organization.
This is later.
No, well, this would have been sometime in the 70s.
Okay, all right. Not while you're a student at BYU.
No.
Okay.
But I remember after I finished and sat down, then Brother Turner took his turn. And honestly, I think his first statement was, and he had come from the South, so I remember his accent. "Well, I guess you can worship anything you want to worship. You can worship the Great Pumpkin if you want to." And then he said a few things that were kind of little personal insulting to me, that because, oh, and I think, had Goodbye, Love You come out? I know, I don't, no, of course it had not. It had not. But he knew that I'd lost something, I'd lost my mother or whatever, and that's why I needed a Heavenly Mother. I mean, something absurd like that.
Some
But
psycho,
anyway,
armchair
yeah,
psychoanalyst.
but that memory just came to me, so there you have
No, it's
that
good.
one.
So, Gerald had disappeared.
Oh yeah, back to my,
Rodney gave a talk, and it
yes.
made you feel.
Oh, listen. My friend Margie and I were sitting, I think, right toward the front, in the middle of his talk. I was crying so vehemently that I got up and ran out and stood underneath. I remember standing underneath the bleachers, and my friend came with me because everything he was saying was hurting me so badly. I just couldn't stand it.
Maybe making you feel like it was your fault that Gerald had disappeared.
Probably, but knowing that what he said was not that, I knew there was something deeply wrong with what he was saying, but because I was in such a vulnerable position, everything just came at me like swords. So anyway, a number of months. Well, some few months later, Gerald called me and he said, "Could you ever forgive a blind man?" or something like that. And so he came over and we talked. And And I still felt that it was a correct thing that Gerald and I marry. And you see, we'll get to all of these things down the line, but I don't look back on that as I made a dreadful mistake. I really feel that somehow I bargained for the kind of experience that that was for me.
Did you seek counsel? Should I marry a gay man? To a leader or a parent?
No.
Didn't want to tell anyone about his past?
I don't think I told anybody. I don't think I did.
Like, you hear that John F. Kennedy had, like, mistresses all over the White House, and even Mitt Romney's dad ran for president, no one talked about the Mormon thing. It seems like there was just this, you didn't talk about stuff, certain stuff back then. Is that part of why you wouldn't have?
I don't feel that I had a need to, I really felt comfortable about going into that marriage. And
spiritually?
Yeah.
Or intellectually or culturally?
I think in every way, I just felt comfortable about doing this. I mean, who would I go to say, should I marry a gay man? I mean, look, even today, our general authorities often say so-called gay. Back then, there was no such thing as a gay man.
Back then?
Yeah. There was, you know, somebody who just made this mistake.
Ah. Gotcha. So some behavior.
Yeah.
Okay.
So okay. We did marry.
Were you ever, like, you know, the traditional make out kissing?
Oh, we did enough kissing and just necking that I loved that. And you see, we will, I'm sure, as we get further into all of this, Gerald was not bisexual, but he did not find me repulsive. Now, isn't that a good thing to know? Which is not the case for, you know, a lot of gay men.
That's right.
They would rather, they throw up in any attempt to have a physical relationship with them.
Right. He was. So, one last question about this. As far as the stereotypes go of being effeminate or hands or mannerisms, did he have that back then?
He didn't necessarily have some of the mannerisms that are really, really evident that we make fun of or that we observe now. He was animated in a way that more often than not, gay men are animated, that straight men, I mean, that's one of the attractive features of a lot of gay men. They're more animated. They're sort of like women in the way their faces can move and their hands can go and whatever. And so, yes, Gerald was that. He wasn't a queenly kind of person.
Did he talk in a feminine way, or this, none of this matters?
I don't
I'm just
think
trying
so.
To set the stage.
No, he didn't have a deep, deep voice, and he didn't have a really big masculine build. But there was nothing necessarily about him besides being the theater and loving music and being animated.
Which are risky.
Of course, very risky.
Very risky.
Very risky, but they're also attractive.
Wonderful. We're going to get to that.
Yeah.
Okay. So you took it back and you believed that he was sincere in having made a mistake.
Oh,
you
yeah.
didn't ask him, what'd you do during those months? Where were you?
Oh, and
were you with another man?
We did talk enough that, I mean, he he was not. I mean, he did not repeat what he would have called his mistakes during that time that we were apart. No.
Okay.
We talked about that.
Okay.
And so we married. Marion D. Hanks married us. It was a wonderful ceremony. And I felt we had a fine honeymoon. And I could not get into Gerald's brain, but I'm sure, it was working the way a gay man's brain works to make sense of having a physical relationship with a woman.
So it was a natural honeemoon, no big problems or hesitance or...
No. But very early on, at least a couple of months into it, and I probably tell this somewhere in Goodbye, I Love You, Gerald just knew that what he'd been hoping for had not happened.
And what was that? Now, talk about what he had talked to the bishop about before he got married.
Do you know, I am having a hard time remembering exactly who Gerald had talked to at what point.
Sure.
But I know he had talked to various people who, of course, just, encouraged him that, you just get over this and you get a good woman. Now, what was your question?
Yeah, just had he been encouraged that if he got married?
Oh, yes.
Had he talked to anyone about it?
Oh, totally.
Had he been encouraged that if he did, a good woman, one wedding night, you're fixed?
I don't know that it was put quite like that way. But, okay, now, this little story, I want to be on here. And I might not ever remember to bring it in. At the same time that Gerald and I were engaged and courting, one of his friends, in fact, one of his roommates who was gay, and I mention him in the book. I probably used a different name. I don't remember. He had been caught at BYU in some kind of thing that insisted that he go up to visit with Spencer W. Kimball, who was, I think, an apostle then and in charge of all the homosexuals in the church. That was his job.
Hmm. Interesting.
That would keep you awake at night, wouldn't it, John? So this friend of ours went up there, and then he got engaged, and they married, I think, just a little, some short while after we did. They went up to visit with President Kimball together. And President Kimball, he wasn't president then, but Elder Kimball, looked at, and I'm not going to use any names here, my friend's fiancé, and said, if you are sufficiently faithful, sufficiently feminine, you can save this man. And I know that because she wrote me a letter after Goodbye, I Love You came out, and in the letter, she used that statement. And then to corroborate it, I sent an email to my friend and asked, is this pretty much what Elder Kimball said to you as you sat? He said, absolutely.
So he lumped it on the woman.
Well, and of course, putting some that this man had to shape up and fly right. But he did say to the woman that. And many years later, and two children later, they divorced. So can you imagine the burden on that woman? I failed.
Yeah.
And I hope and believe that at this point she does not believe that.
Sure.
So, but that's where we were at that point. And I have talked to so many dozens of LDS men who, in council with Elder Kimball and others, were pretty much promised. My friend Trevor is pretty open about his journey. And he had to or did consult with Elder Kimball, who pretty much laid out the plan that marriage is part of what's going to give you the direction that you need on this.
Yeah.
And somewhere or other, Gerald, and I've heard other men say this, was told you would be better off at the bottom of the Great Salt Lake with a millstone around your neck than being a homosexual. That's where we were at that time. A really difficult, sad place. And that's where a lot of people still are.
So you said a couple months into it,
Gerald
was disappointed.
He just gradually realized. And he had this huge emotional life going on inside of him. And he just knew that the things he had hoped for of this change in the way he operated inside had not happened. And I probably tell in there, he told me later, he was listening to a radio broadcast and heard Matthew Arnold's poem. Some little while into the marriage, Gerald realized that what he had been hoping for, of a real change inside of the way that he was experiencing himself emotionally and sexually, that it would change. He realized that that was not going to happen. And I do write about it there in Goodbye, I Love You, if you wanted to.
Yep, absolutely. Maybe start around here and just kind of...
And see, I haven't read this for a long
time.
Well,
fortunately, last night I did, and the night before, so...
Whoa, On a Sunday morning, we were lazing in bed waiting for the time to get ready for church. Gerald seemed in a pensive mood and didn't want to talk. He turned on the radio to listen, and as he often did, to the Sunday morning poetry reading on KSL. The rich male voice introduced the next poem, The Buried Life by Matthew Arnold. I watched Gerald's face as he listened, absorbed. Alas, is even love too weak to unlock the heart and let it speak? Are even lovers powerless to reveal to one another what indeed they feel? I knew the mass of men concealed their thoughts for fear that if revealed, they would by other men be met with blank indifference or with blame reproved. I knew they lived and moved, tricked in disguises alien to the rest of men and alien to themselves, and yet the same heart beats in every human breast. There were tears on Gerald's cheeks. Why were there tears on Gerald's cheeks? He took a long, loud breath and stared at the ceiling. But often in the din of strife, there rises an unspeakable desire after the knowledge of our buried life, a thirst to spend our fire and restless force in tracking out our true original course, a longing to inquire into the mystery of this heart which beats so wild, so deep in us, to know whence our lives come and where they go. Gerald cried quietly, and then gave himself over to great heaving sobs. I was paralyzed. What was this? Gerald was my rock. I couldn't have him shaking like this. I pulled him into my arms and pressed my cheek to his hair. He let me comfort him for a moment and then turned away. It's nothing, he said in a strange voice. It's just me, just life. I took his hand and was quiet. No one can be strong all the time, I thought. Anything so bright as he would have to have a dark side. I'll just let it be, and it will take care of itself. Gerald can handle anything. He'll be fine. We'll be fine. In a few minutes, he'll turn over and look at me and smile, and then we'll get up and go to church. Yeah, This thirst to spend our fire and restless force in tracking out our true original course. Yeah, Gerald was was unremitting in his hunger to know and to feel what to him was the reality of his soul. And to those who find it very easy to condemn and say, you can't even use the word soul like this, you know, this is just some dirty thing over here at the side. To Gerald, and I'm sure to many, if not most, who are aware, their experience of who they are that includes their homosexuality is to them a very deep part of their soul in a way that we who are outside looking in don't understand.
Thank you for joining us today on Mormon Stories. To comment on this episode or to discuss it with others, please check us out online at mormonstories.org. If you want to find other friends, family members, former missionary companions, or ward members who approach Mormonism like you, consider adding me, John DeLynn, as your Facebook friend. This may seem like a strange idea, but many of my closest friends have discovered that they are not alone in their thoughts or feelings or family or even ward situation through discovering mutual Facebook friends. Finally, to keep Mormon Stories alive, please consider a donation at mormonstories.org. Music on this episode was provided by Clayton and Sky Pixton.